On today's show, we are going to continue to look at Gaza, at the Israeli genocide of Palestinians there. We are going to hear first an interview on Judge Neopolitano of Jeffrey Sachs. Professor Jeffrey Sachs is an expert on the Middle East, and the title of his piece is Can Netanyahu Steal Syria? And following that, we will hear from Senator Merkley from Oregon, his remarks about the holidays that were delivered on the U.S. Senate floor on December 21st. So first, Professor Jeffrey Sachs. This was December 17th on Judge Neopolitano.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Neopolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, December 17, 2024. Apologies for the late start. Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us now. Professor Sachs, always a pleasure, my dear friend. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
I want to
speak at some length about what's going on in Syria, particularly the reprehensible land grabs in which the IDF has been engaging. Ambassador Murray told us this morning that the IDF has seized land equivalent to three times the size of the Gaza Strip. But before we get there, there was an assassination this morning of a very high-ranking general, General Kirillov, outside of his apartment building in Moscow. It was startling, and he and his aide were killed by a bomb. The Ukrainians have taken credit, so to speak, for it. What does this tell you, Professor Sachs, about the state of the war between Russia and Ukraine, that Ukraine would do something like this?
This kind of terrorism should have no place, even in the context of war. But what it means is that we are continuing to be at the brink of disaster, that at any moment this war could spiral into something even more god-awful than it is right now, into escalation, nuclear escalation. What is happening is that governments or leaders are saying, we have no respect for any limits. And this is especially, by the way, and I know people will take exception to this, but this is on, quote, our side, the U.S., Ukraine, Israel. We are murdering foreigners that are, yes, adversaries, but are often negotiators or senior officials of government. This is state policy of Ukraine. They didn't even try to hide this. They, as you said, took credit for it. The United States murders foreign officials. And by the way, I think it's true to say domestic people as well. And Israel absolutely has been in the business for decades of murdering its so-called or self-defined adversaries. But in particular, in the last couple of years, the ones that it's murdered are its political interlocutors, the very ones aiming to negotiate ceasefires or peace agreements. The political negotiator of Hamas, the leader of Hezbollah, and these are outright assassinations. These are not killings that are in the context of military actions where buildings or blocks or cities are bombed. These are targeted assassinations. Well, my God, where are we going with all of this? I can tell you, the longer this continues, the more danger that we just end up all getting blown up.
You know, this was so well planned, so methodical, so neat and clean, so to speak. It's almost as if the Mossad did it, but
well, by the way, there's a lot of interaction of the CIA, the Mossad, the Ukrainian intelligence. Yes, these are methods that are championed by, again, I'll say it, quote, our side, although you don't really feel it's much for us, the normal people. But these are deliberate methods, and you won't hear complaints or scoffing. Not at all. It may have been done together with the U.S. Who knows? And when Israel does these things, murdering the very people that they're negotiating with, the U.S. doesn't blink an eye, because probably it's been done together with the U.S. It's so astoundingly reckless and dangerous.
In former intelligence community colleagues of yours that are on the show have nothing but praise for the professionalism of the Russian intelligence community. I'm sure that they will soon find out who's behind. I'm going to run a clip from President Putin. Now, this is before the murder of the general. This was yesterday when he was addressing a large contingent of his senior defense folks. I'd like your thoughts on it, Chris. Cut number 13.
At the same time, under the guise of a mythical Russian threat, they simply scare their population with the fact that we are going to attack someone. The tactics are very simple. They bring us to the red line through which we are retreating from the ancient Soviet Union, now Russian threats. Meanwhile, the NATO countries themselves are increasing military spending near the Russian borders. The formation and cobbling together of NATO have long gone beyond the so-called zone of its historical responsibility. In addition, the so-called Eastern Flank, the alliance is increasing its presence in the Asia-Pacific region. With the support of the United States, new military and political alliances are being formed that undermines the security architecture that has developed over decades.
I think he's got his finger right on the pulse of things. By the way, the general that was murdered was in the audience. He wasn't shown in the clip that we saw, but he was there.
We're heading towards World War III, and this is actually chortled in Washington. War with China by 2027, and so on. If the Biden or Biden-Harris administration had continued, we would go right over the cliff. The question now that is extremely important is whether Donald Trump will do something different, and he might. By the way, there is, at least in his rhetoric, repeatedly statements that we should not be at war with Russia. We should not be at war with China. He says that repeatedly. I'm taking some cautious hope from it, because if it's real, it's a huge advance on what we have of this outgoing administration, which has been absolutely dreadful, which has made it its point to be absolutely disrespectful and caustic and even murderous about the red lines of our adversaries. Now, the issue with the incoming Trump administration is that that there are people of all ilks in Washington, in the new administration, some stated hardliners, some people who say we've had enough war, we have to end the war. We have President Trump's rhetoric. We have three war zones, by the way. Of course, we have Ukraine, we have the Middle East, and we have East Asia. And some people say, oh, war in this one, but not in this one. Some say, why are we provoking World War III in any of these places? Donald Trump has talked about that he doesn't want war with China, that the two countries could solve problems together. Well, if such rhetoric is actually turned into action and addresses what President Putin accurately stated in that clip, he stated accurately that there is a massive Western U.S.-led military buildup that is taking place across all of these conflict zones, and that it's extraordinarily dangerous. If President Trump aims to wind this down, my own view is give him three Nobel Peace Prizes, one for ending the Ukraine war, one for ending the violence in the Middle East and one for ending the potential utter disaster in East Asia, if he does it. And this is the big question for us.
Well, and then you and I, before we get to Syria, you and I this morning each read a reprehensible piece by Mitch McConnell, the outgoing majority leader in the Senate, which sounded like John McCain on steroids. And I fear that that view that America must continue its hegemony, that America must dominate, I fear that that view is shared by more than half the Republican senators, well more than half.
Yeah, so the key word in this piece, which people can download from Foreign Affairs Magazine, because it's made, I think, openly available for everybody, is primacy.
Right.
What Mitch McConnell says is we need U.S. primacy. What U.S. primacy means to Russia or to China is the U.S. wants to lord it over us. The U.S. wants to dominate us. The U.S. wants to have its way and threaten us as it will. What it literally means in the case of Russia is the U.S. wants to put its missile systems and its military bases in Ukraine along our border or in the South Caucasus in Georgia, and in fact, do whatever the U.S. wants. That's what primacy means from the Russian point of view. It's, of course, a matter of core national security for Russia to reject such a world that Mitch McConnell is calling for. What primacy means in East Asia is that the United States surrounds China with its military in Japan, in Korea, or in Australia, New Zealand, in Southeast Asia, in the East China Sea, in the South China Sea, in the choke points in the Indian Ocean and the Straits of Malacca, that the U.S. puts in intermediate range missiles in Korea or wherever it wants. From China's point of view, again, this is fundamentally against China's core national security, especially when they saber rattle about Taiwan and so forth, which is part of China, and the United States says is part of China. So when Mitch McConnell talks about primacy, we have to understand from the point of view of the other parties, they see this as dire and direct threat to their core national security. Is that really making America safe by making Russia feel that they're absolutely at the brink or on the knife edge of war? Does it really make the American people safe when China feels that the United States is threatening China's core national security? Of course it doesn't. It leads to a world in which we are at each other's throats and we're seconds away from nuclear war. And as we've talked about, the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts us at 90 seconds to nuclear Armageddon. Mm. So Mitch McConnell expresses, yes, a popular view that is absolutely insane. I'm sorry to say it. It's insane. It is a view that says we're going to act in a way which is going to put us to the very brink of nuclear war. Why would any U.S. politician say such a stupid thing? But of course, Mitch McConnell's an old and stupid man, I'm sorry to say. Go, leave already. This is so dangerous for us. And to see this after 30 years of this kind of claim of U.S. primacy that has gotten us into nonstop wars in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in Iraq, in Ukraine, that is leading to massive arms buildups around China and a surge of China's own military spending in response to the U.S. military spending. Enough of this. This is 30 years of delusion that has brought us to the brink of nuclear war. And it's it's really time for Mitch McConnell to leave, but at least he did us a slight favor by being so blunt about the idiocy of the foreign policy that he promotes. So reckless and so dangerous and so lacking the most basic core insight that if we want to be safe, you don't put the knife on the throat of the other side when it's a nuclear superpower and expect that's going to make us safe.
Right. Professor Sachs, switching gears, does Syria still exist as a geopolitical entity?
No, not for the moment, because it is multiple military forces that are fighting each other, that are dividing up the country. And we have Turkish-backed jihadist forces. We have American-backed Kurdish forces. We have the Russian presence on the coast. We have Israel having invaded Syria 3 days ago. We have these absolute madmen in the Israeli government, two ministers, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are mad, absolutely mad, saying, yes, this is greater Israel now. This is where we stand. And all of this is pointing towards wider war. And of course, Netanyahu, always for dragging America into yet another war, wants to drag us into a war with Iran now. And that's part of the immediate plan, not even hidden from view. Israel has bombed the air defenses of Syria, and there are stories coming right and left that, of course, this gives an open airspace for the United States entry to bomb Iran. And Netanyahu hasn't been Netanyahu if he hasn't basically said every single day to the United States, go to war with Iran. And of course, he's saying it again now. So Syria is being eaten alive. And all of this is a part of Netanyahu's effort to expand Israel, to create now a greater Israel that encompasses not only Israel, not only Palestine, but parts of Lebanon, parts of Syria, and to listen to some of these nutcases, parts of Egypt as well, because if you look at the texts from 700 BC, well, it seems like part of Egypt is promised to the zealots. So this is really, really, and what does the U.S. administration do? That's all fine. Everything's fine. Whatever Israel does, that'll be temporary. We support this. Not a glimmer of coherence. Anyway, we're counting the days for Biden to leave. But I'm worried with the incoming Trump administration also, there hasn't been a voice yet that says, let's ratchet down the war in the Middle East, because the power of the Israel lobby is both parties, and it's very powerful and it's very dangerous. And
what will happen, in your view, to all of this real estate? Ambassador Craig Murray told us a little while ago, I mentioned this in the introduction to the show, that Israel has already seized Syrian land that is more than three times the size of the Gaza Strip. I mean, would any international order, would the UN, would any other countries beside the US recognize the legitimacy of this? It's
of
just
course not.
Theft.
This is, well, it's not only theft, it's completely illegal in international law. The world will obviously oppose this. Israel has not only seized this land, it's by many reports, 15 or 20 kilometers outside of Damascus right now. This is a major invasion by Israel. And with these zealots, and they are zealots, they're 7th century BC zealots, by the way, that's what they are. They are saying, yeah, we're going to move in. We even see rabbis going to talk about the new settlements that are going to be in the Syrian territory that's captured. I mean, you just cannot believe the irresponsibility and the lack of an American foreign policy, because the Israel lobby owns American foreign policy, completely contrary to America's interests.
It may very well own the Trump foreign policy with even a greater depth of control than the Biden foreign policy because of the public statements he's made, Mrs. Adelson, the amount of money she's given, and other folks that he has appointed, even Tulsi Gabbard, who has some views about the CIA consistent with yours and mine, is an ardent Zionist, as is everybody else in his national security team. I don't know if they're all going to be confirmed by the Senate, but this is the mindset that he has chosen.
I think that it's very important for
Sebastian Gorka. Sebastian Gorka sounds like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, speaking a little better English.
I think that it's very important for people to differentiate two basic ideas. One is that Israel should have security, something that I believe in and agree with. And the other, this concept of greater Israel, based on ancient texts 2,700 years ago that ride roughshod on millions of people in complete violation of every standard of morality, ethics, and law of the world today. So if we're living in 7th century BC guided by a quite genocidal text, by the way, which these people read, and it says, go kill everyone in this territory because this is your territory. Well, that's the kind of world that we're going to get. Being in favor of Israel's security is one thing, but Israel has its borders on the 4th of June, 1967. Those are Israel's legal borders. The International Court of Justice just said that again, but that goes back 57 years, actually, to the fall of 1967 after the war in that year, when in UN Security Council Resolution 242, it was already said that those occupied lands are not Israel's, but Israel is in the hands of absolute extremists of the most shocking sort who are talking about the physical expansion of Israel, not only to rule over Palestine, that is the Palestine that isn't killed, slaughtered, or ethnically cleansed, but also Lebanon, Syria, and it goes on the maps of some of these crazy people. So this is what we're up against. Now, is it really true that people in the incoming Trump administration are going to champion a map of greater Israel that is a map that has Israel taking territory in Egypt, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Iraq onward? Is that really what we're going to do? Because then we're going to drive to the end of the world in nuclear war, because it's so crazy. You can't even imagine that people would say this. So people have to define their terms. It's one thing to support Israel's security. It's another thing to believe that the American military and American foreign policy is dedicated to the delusions of people reading 2,700-year-old texts about slaughtering peoples so that there can be a greater Israel. It's a question of what we mean by all of these terms.
Do you foresee American military involvement in Netanyahu's expansionist plans? Apparently, we are bombing portions of Syria, and we know there's 1,000 troops on the ground. I would defy anybody to justify this in terms of American national security, and you would as well, I think.
None of what's happened in the last, I'll say, 21 years under Netanyahu's guidance has been for U.S. security. Netanyahu talked the American people into war with Iraq. That was his war. Netanyahu talked the Clinton people into overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi. Netanyahu talked the American government under Clinton into trying to overthrow Bashar al-Assad starting in 2011. Netanyahu talked America into wars across this region. Has any of this been about American security? No way. Not at all. America's more insecure, more in danger, more indebted than ever before because of this radical policy. So the one thing I'm hoping President Trump talks about making America great again, at least make America sovereign again. Let's have our own foreign policy, not dictated by another country, not dictated by Ukraine, which could get us into World War III, not dictated by Israel, which could get us into World War III. Let's have our own foreign policy that is based on American security.
I think he believes that, with the exception of Israel, in part because of his longstanding relationship with the donor class. So
yeah, it's true.
But you know, this is Jeff. I don't see any relief with respect to Israel. I don't see any relief coming. I just see, unless something happens domestically that removes Netanyahu from the scene, which is not unforeseeable. I don't see American foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel and America continuing to give Israel everything it wants changing under Trump. Do you?
Donald Trump should explain to his donors, thank you for putting me into office. I'm here to serve American well-being and American security. Thank you very much. He is absolutely in the most decisive position, of course, in the whole world to keep us out of nuclear war, to keep us out of a spreading war. I'm sorry, whether it's Miriam Adelson or anyone else, they have no business even remotely trying to run American national security policy. None at all. And I think President Trump knows that. And I think it behooves him to tell his donors, thank you very much for all the support. And now I, as President of the United States, will look after American national security.
Professor Sachs, from your lips to President Trump's ears.
Let's hope.
Yes. Thank you very much for your time, my dear friend. I have pages of notes to discuss with you. I barely scratched the surface. One of these
Let's continue. We'll continue.
Certainly continue. One of these days we'll do it together in the same room and for a longer period of time. We have Fantastic. A short week next week. I hope we can squeeze you in before Christmas.
Let's do that.
And that was an interview with Professor Jeffrey Sachs on the Judge Napolitano Show. Coming up next, we have the December 21st, 2024 remarks on the U.S. Senate floor by Oregon Senator Jeff Markley. He talks about the holiday, but he is stressing the suffering that's going on in Gaza. So here is Senator Jeff Markley.
President, we are all here getting ready to leave after we fund the government and return home to our families. We get pretty excited about this time of year, thinking about the holidays to come. We're heading home to our loved ones. We know there will be extended family gatherings. There will be games with the children. There will be exchanges of presents. And there will be food. There will be awesome food. Ham, turkey, all kinds of wonderfully crafted vegetable dishes. And there will be so much that we can drink. Oh, yes, there will be wine varieties. There will be eggnog. Perhaps some of it will be spiked. There will be carbonated apple juice or cranberry juice for the kids. We'll put it into glasses. We'll have toast. We will really celebrate life. We'll celebrate life with a roof over our head, with our loved ones close by, and with our cupboards well stocked. But also in these holidays, there will be time for reflection in every religious tradition. And for those of us who are fortunate to have that roof over our head and food in the cupboard and our loved ones close by, we will recognize that for so many, that is not the case. For so many here in the United States, who by virtue of economic conditions or the ravages of disease or mental afflictions, they will not have a roof over their head. They may not have family members close by. They may not even have a cupboard, let alone one that's well stocked. And we'll ponder our responsibility to try to improve those conditions. And we will ponder the landscape across the broader globe, knowing that in many places, people have been so ravaged by natural disasters, so affected by conflict and war. I'm sure we'll see programs and commentary about Sudan, where millions have been displaced by civil war and by drought and by famine, or in Burma, where so many are suffering escalating violence, or in Ukraine, where people are brutalized by Putin's invasion, the efforts to defend their country. No matter where you look, there is no shortage of suffering. But the place that weighs heaviest on my heart this season is the Middle East. We have the families of Israel continuing to grieve the loss of 1,200 of their own loved ones on October 7th, 2023. We have families in Israel that continue to not know the fate of their loved ones taken hostage, whether they are alive, whether they are dead, whether they're being cared for, whether they're suffering. Will they be released? There will be an empty chair at the table. The victims in Israel weigh on my heart, but the Palestinian victims also weigh on my heart. Individuals on the West Bank, Palestinians who suffer from decades of occupation, of the economic constraints and indignity that come from checkpoints, that come from land lost to settlements and to outposts, to olive orchards bulldozed down, to lives lost and injuries suffered from increasing violence by settlers against Palestinian villagers. But by far the most devastated communities are the Palestinian communities in Gaza, both because of the extraordinary level of devastation, and it weighs on my heart because of the connection between the United States and Israel, our close connection with our ally, where we share security strategies, where we provide economic and military assistance. We share intelligence on the issues of the world. We are so closely connected that we are connected to the devastation in Gaza. Since October 7th, 2023, more than 45,000 Palestinians in Gaza have died. More than 100,000 have been severely injured. The vast bulk of those injured and those who have died are women and children and seniors, people who have no connection whatsoever to Hamas that conducted the raids on October 7th of 2023. The devastation is massive. This same picture taken in North Gaza could be almost copied for community after community from north to south of Gaza. Of the 2.1 million people, the Palestinians in Gaza, some 1.9 million, almost everyone that is without a home, either because their home has been blasted into smithereens or because they have been forcibly moved to a different location within Gaza. Forced relocation. A year ago, Senator Van Hollen and I went to Rafah Gate. We hoped to get inside Gaza to see with our own eyes and talk to people and understand better the devastation. But what we heard a year ago was that all the fundamentals for a normal community were devastated. Shelter, I've already spoken to, the 1.9 million people relocated either because they were forced to flee or because their home no longer exists. That the phone networks were down, the cell networks were down. That the internet networks were down. And even if they were up, people had very little opportunity to recharge their cell phones because there wasn't electricity. So the power was down. The transportation was down because many roads were impassable. Food was in short supply, driving malnutrition a year ago. Clean water was often unavailable a year ago. The transportation was down because many roads were impassable. Food was in short supply, driving malnutrition a year ago. Clean water was often unavailable a year ago. A year ago, Senator Van Hollen and I could not get into Gaza. Reporters have not been allowed into Gaza except for very carefully monitored short visits monitored by the Netanyahu government. Humanitarian organizations were having a hard time getting in and often had to do a very careful exchange of an exact number for exact number coming out. But as we stood there at that gate, a couple doctors came out. And I spent some time talking to them. And one of them was a burn specialist who described how hard it was to treat many of the massive burns that he had witnessed. The other was a bone doctor. And he said, I can treat the broken bones, but I can't necessarily treat the soft tissue damage that comes from the shockwaves that emanate from all the explosions taking down the buildings. The impact, he said, of the blast radius in terms of the shockwaves was even greater than the physical damage. And we were able to talk to humanitarian organizations of aid workers who had been in Gaza, and they said, understand this, that we are seasoned workers who have been in the worst places in the world. We have been in Yemen. We have been on the front line of Ukraine. We have been in Sudan. Nothing compares to the devastation in Gaza. That was a year ago. I was particularly affected by hearing about the challenge of mothers. Mothers receive our attention, particularly when they are carrying babies, because all our efforts go to make sure that that delivery, that child will come safely into the world, healthy into the world, the mother will be cared for. But what we heard from the humanitarian organizations were that hunger was driving malnutrition. Malnutrition made people more susceptible to disease. And for mothers, it meant increases in miscarriages, increases in stillbirth, increases in very low birth weight babies, increases in the difficulty of mothers breastfeeding their children because they were too malnourished to produce milk, and babies getting sick because when formula was used, if available, the water might be contaminated. Think about the children you've brought into the world, that your wife or your partner has brought into the world, and how horrific it would be to see those circumstances. This time of year is a time of year in my spiritual tradition where we think a lot about the challenges Mary went through. She and Joseph were traveling from Galilee to Bethlehem, and they were traveling there at the time that Mary was very pregnant with Jesus because a census had been ordered by the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus, and they were required to be there and report to Joseph's ancestral home of Bethlehem. Traveling the roads when pregnant, very hard. And then they weren't able to find a room in Bethlehem. And yet, Mary went into labor and delivered in a barn. Not ideal circumstances. And because this time of year, and because we think about that story so much, the mothers in Gaza, their conditions so much worse. It's something we can connect with. And now the children in Gaza, they're entering the second year in this devastation. Some have some format of school, but many do not. Now, we here in America know what COVID did to interrupt the education of our children. Some did well with tutors. Many suffered isolation. Many suffered setbacks in what they learned. Many are still carrying that challenge forward as they seek education. So we can also connect to the children of Gaza who have had their education, their life so disrupted, a life disrupted by lack of food and water, instability, lack of safety. 2 weeks ago, an ambassador from the Middle East drew attention to a part of Gaza in worse shape than the rest of Gaza. And he referred to this area, was specifically, it's North Gaza. And where is North Gaza? You have North Gaza, Northern Gaza, and Southern Gaza separated by the Netzarim corridor. It travels from Israel to the Mediterranean Sea. But then within Northern Gaza, you have Gaza City and then communities. Bet Lahia, Bet Hanan, and Jabala. And in those communities, he said, there's 65,000 people who are starving to death because food cannot get in. 65,000 people starving. Now, we know the food conditions have been horrific in Gaza for a year. But in this case, sustained prevention of food getting in, and people are starving. Well, he asserted this, so I asked a visiting official from another Middle Eastern country about this, and he emphasized, yes. Yes, he said, there are, in fact, 65,000 people or more starving in northern Gaza, isolated from the rest of the world. Okay, well, that's two officials. But that's a big thing to say. But then this came out. Gaza humanitarian access snapshot number 8. It is co-signed by 30 organizations. Organizations like Save the Children, like CARE, like Mercy Corps, and 27 others. And what do they say in this report? They say 65,000 to 75,000 people are trapped without food, water, electricity, or reliable health care. That's a direct quote from the report of these 30 humanitarian organizations. It goes on to say humanitarian aid has been almost entirely blocked for 60 days. It goes on to say that only three hospitals remain partially operational with restricted access, very little health care. It says the population faces imminent risks of disease, starvation, and violence without urgent relief. Without urgent relief. I called up Cindy McCain. We know Cindy well here. Cindy McCain is the executive director of the World Food Program. She is the spouse of our former deceased colleague, John McCain. And I said to her, is this right? Are 65,000 people isolated in North Gaza for week after week after week, no deliveries of food or virtually none? And she said, yes. She said, yes, that is the case. And she didn't just say to me, she also talked about Gaza more broadly. And she said, we can no longer sit by and just allow these people to starve to death. Children, especially, she said, are starving to death. The height of malnutrition, the height of hunger with that region is unbelievably horrible. In November, the United Nations made 41 attempts to deliver aid to this section, North Gaza, to the besieged people trapped in North Gaza. 37 of the 41 attempts were blocked by the Netanyahu government. Four other deliveries were not blocked, but were troubled. Here is the situation. A year ago, we heard that if there isn't sufficient food, chaos will ensue because starving people will storm whatever truck there is that has food because they are desperate. The trucks won't be able to make it to the warehouse, or if they do make it to the warehouse will be sacked. We are now in the very condition that the humanitarian organizations told us would happen. So very little food being allowed in, what is being allowed in, can't be distributed in any significant organized fashion, and people are starving. And even if those four truckloads could have been at the warehouse and distributed, too little food, microscopic amount of food for the 65,000 people who are there. So, here we are now. Gaza's destruction, this destruction that we saw on that previous chart, this destruction, this is carried out by American bombs. This is how we are complicit in this situation. It is our munitions that are being used by the Israeli Defense Forces to produce this result. We are connected, and therefore we are morally connected to the situation in Gaza. Our weapon packages have included 50,000 120-millimeter high-explosive mortar rounds. Our provisions have included more than 32,000 120-millimeter tank rounds, more than 14,000 2,000-pound bombs and 6,500 500-pound bombs and hundreds of 250-pound bombs. Think about a 2,000-pound bomb. This is like the biggest bomb. And the New York Times described how when it's dropped, it is designed to break fortified military bunkers. It will create a massive crater 40 to 50 feet wide. And when it explodes, it will shatter, and I quote, into razor-sharp fragments that can kill or incapacitate people over several hundred feet. You kind of get the feeling how any bomb like that is indiscriminate. Whether it's dropped on the intended building or it falls somewhere further afield, it kills a tremendous number of civilians. We are providing those bombs. Now, the Biden administration suspended the delivery of 200-pound bombs to the Netanyahu government because of that, and also suspended the 500-pound bombs. But the Wall Street Journal reported in July that the delivery had been restored of the 500-pound bombs. The point here is we continue to be deeply connected and tied to this devastation in Gaza. And it's not just the devastation of civilians, it's also American law, and it's also international law. National Security Memorandum 20, a process that was created because of the work of my colleague, Senator Van Hollen, says this: it is reasonable to assess, the report on this says, it's reasonable to assess that defense articles covered have been used by Israeli security forces inconsistent with international humanitarian law and the obligations for mitigating civilian harm. And so, what have we done? It was last February, now 10 months ago, that a group of us called on the United States for Operation Gaza Relief. We must at least provide massive amounts of humanitarian aid so people are not starving in Gaza. We have that responsibility. If we are urging Israel to provide the aid, which is the best strategy, but they do not do it, we have the obligation to provide it. And we did so little. We have the most massive sea lift capability in the world, and we didn't use a single bit of it to address a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We have two hospital ships that have 1,000 beds each, and we did not move them into the Mediterranean to help out. We did not encourage other nations to provide their hospital ships. Now, we did do one modest thing. We did a floating pier that operated intermittently from May to July that had all kinds of problems breaking up in the waves. It provided, ultimately, at the best estimate, enough food for people of Gaza for a week. Not at all addressing the magnitude of the challenge. We had a responsibility to provide help independent of any other cessation of hostilities, and we failed. And yes, we pressed for a cessation of hostilities, we pressed for a ceasefire, and I applaud the administration for doing so. But while that failed, we also failed. We, America, failed in our responsibility to provide relief to the humanitarian suffering on which we are so closely connected. Our own law says that if our aid is impeded, as it has been by the Netanyahu government, that we cannot provide arms. But we have been violating our own law. 620I, no assistance shall be furnished under this act, the Arms Export Control Act, to any country when it's made known to the president that the government of such country prohibits or otherwise restricts directly or indirectly the transport or delivery of United States humanitarian assistance. We have a moral responsibility, and we have a legal responsibility. So we must do more. We must do more in the remaining weeks of this administration. We must do more in the opening year of the next administration, because these issues of moral responsibility, these issues of international law, do not depend on who sits in the Oval Office. So as we stand here about to go home and celebrate with our big plates of food and our full pitchers of wine, as we read our cards calling for peace in the world, as we offer our prayers, let us not forget those who suffer in the Middle East. Let us not forget the families who lost their family members on October 7th in Israel. Let us not forget the families in Israel whose hostages, whose family members are still held hostage. Let us not forget those on the West Bank suffering the afflictions of local violence. But most of all, let us not forget the victims in Gaza, and do all we can under our moral responsibility, under our legal responsibility, to come to their aid. Thank you, Mr. President.